Our next case is 2020-337, the State of Ohio versus Jacob R. LaRosa. For the appellant, Ms. Morrow.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal time?
Okay. Proceed.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Lynn Morrow, and I represent Jacob LaRosa. On March 31st, 2015, Officer Biddleston with the Niles Police Department was directed by his captain to proceed to St. Joseph's Hospital in Warren with lights and sirens activated. He was given a directive, two directives: secure a homicide suspect, 15-year-old Jacob LaRosa, and seize evidence. And that's what he did when he arrived at the hospital. He began to take items out of the hospital room and place them in the trunk of his vehicle. He removed Jacob's mom from the room and handcuffed Jacob to the bed. While the nurse was attending to Jacob, Officer Biddleston directed her to place his only clothing, underwear and socks, in a bag and give that bag to him.
Counselor, let me stop. Can I stop you for a minute? When you say the officer is directed to seize evidence, directed by whom?
His captain. The captain sent him to the hospital for two reasons. Officer Biddleston testified at the suppression hearing. Those two reasons were secure Jacob and seize evidence.
Now, but the superior's instruction to seize evidence doesn't abrogate any law, seizure law, by which the officer was required to operate under, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And a suppression motion was filed challenging the seizure of the evidence. The trial court denied that motion, and 2 weeks later, Jacob pled no contest to the charges of aggravated murder, aggravated robbery, aggravated burglary, and attempted rape. When the prosecutor listed the predicate facts to support a finding of guilt on a no contest plea, he listed the evidence taken from the hospital room to support the conviction.
Ms. Morrow.
Right. And that's the essence of this case, correct? Whether the seizure of the clothing, the items taken from the hospital, was lawful.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
putting aside the clothing, but I'm going to talk about the washcloth. Okay.
Okay.
What is your best argument that you have any right to keep that out? Wasn't that the property of the hospital?
No, it was not the property of the hospital. The Fourth District addressed issues of when you're seeking medical treatment, what's the hospital's, what's the patient's. And quite frankly, in that case, it was urine in a catheter that the nurse was going to dump down the drain. And the Fourth District said, listen, you may give up your expectation of some privacy with regard to the hospital and what they can do and what they're allowed to remove, but that certainly doesn't give the hospital then authority to turn items over to the police without a warrant. And that's what happened here. When they're using
items. So a third party, you're saying a third party can't just hand the government its own property?
Not a third party that has a legal obligation to maintain the privacy and privileges of the patients. We have statutes in Ohio that govern when medical personnel can disclose information. None of the exceptions apply here. We have federal laws protecting our medical rights, what tests we're getting, where we're getting them, when we're getting them, how we're getting them. The hospital jettisoned all those privilege requirements and just turned this information over to the officer.
But Ms. Morrow, he never was admitted. He was in a cordoned off by curtains area of the emergency room. And in with the officer there, so much of that was in plain sight. I mean, isn't there a difference that he wasn't fully admitted into the hospital? I mean, he had voluntarily presented himself to the emergency room.
First of all, in Thompson versus Louisiana, the United States Supreme Court made clear that when you call for help, you don't give up your privacy rights. So even if he was there as a victim seeking help, which he was not, he doesn't give up his privacy rights. Secondly, the record does not support those conclusions. He was in room 7. If you listen to Officer Biddleston's body cam, he goes through a maze of hallways, has to be buzzed back. There's no one else there other than the medical staff. This wasn't an emergency room that you just walk in and can see what's happening. Jacob was-
Let me ask you this. Would the officer have been able to go to the hospital and ask questions if your client was willing to speak to him? Would they be able to go? And of course, he'd have to give him, he was a suspect, so he'd have to deliver the Miranda rights, correct?
That's correct. And that happened much later with a different officer who came after all these items were seized.
So he went to the hospital and the police officer had a right to do so. How do you address the fact that all this evidence is in plain sight, following up on Justice Bruner's question?
Well, he didn't have a right to go in there with the intent to seize evidence without warrant. So he wasn't in there lawfully to begin with. He went in there with the intent to seize evidence, not to just engage with Jacob and talk to him and get the lay of the land. He went in as directed. So he wasn't lawfully entering that room to begin with. And in Athens versus Wolf,
explain why he wasn't lawfully entering the room. He was a detective who was working on a murder case and was ordered to secure the defendant, the suspect, which do you find that he had no right to do that?
You know, he had no right to do that any more than he would have had a right to walk into someone's house if they were a murder suspect and secure them.
Hold on. How can you say that, right? It wasn't this. What, he didn't walk in the suspect's house. He walked into the hospital. Only the hospital could object to him being there, would have standing to complain about it.
No, it's not only the hospital who has standing.
Yes, it is.
It's
only
his
the hospital.
Room.
You only have a right to keep people out of your property. You don't have a right to. He has no claim if someone comes into a public hospital.
But that's not really the issue.
The issue is whether or not there was a right to seize this property. Right. I mean, you keep talking about expectation of privacy, but that's not the standard, right? The standard is whether or not he had a possessory interest in the property, right?
Yes.
Okay.
In addition, on the privacy issue, you
seem to be confused about searches and seizures and expectation of privacy, and you should be between searches and expectation of privacy, and this is a seizure. So the issue is whether or not he had a possessory interest, whether or not he's retained ownership of the property. So maybe you could address that.
He did maintain ownership of the property. Bailment law is clear, and the case law that has construed hospitals turning over items have made clear the hospital may have a right to have them, but they have an obligation to maintain them for the rightful owner, the patient.
Counsel, at what point did the washcloth become your client's property?
The moment his urine and blood was placed on it.
Wait a second. Okay. Does he have to give the hospital the permission to wash the linens that he's laying on, or the clothing that they put on him, the hospital gowns, etc.? When they take that away from him, can he have the right to object and say, no, leave that here, it's mine now?
He would have a right to object, just like in Funk, the patient had a right to object if they were going to throw his urine away and instead chose to give it to the police. Once you were in that private setting.
Wait a minute, counsel, there's a big difference between someone's bodily fluid that is segregated and the linens from a hospital that are used to attend to a patient. Where's the possessory interest in the hospital's property that is being used, under your theory, then any syringe or any needle or any instrument that was used to treat him becomes his.
Under those situations in State v. Funk, the court cited Ferguson versus Charleston, the hospital doesn't have a right to turn over syringes, vials, catheters, anything else to the police just because the police come in and ask for it. They need to get a warrant. They could have secured the area and made sure things weren't destroyed and followed the proper procedures to get a warrant.
They did get a warrant for the hand swabs and getting the evidence from his hands, correct?
They did, based upon the evidence they improperly seized. But
that's different in that they're taking that physically from the defendant. Let me go back brief. I'm not as clear as Justice DeWine is on the entry into the hospital. So of course the officer can enter into a hospital. And I guess if you go into a curtain area where a patient is, and in this case where your client is, that the officer has the right to do so if the hospital personnel has let him do so. Does your client have the right to tell him to leave? And if so, would he have to leave? And did that happen?
He had a right to tell them to leave. He was so incoherent that he couldn't even form a sentence or complete a word. He was stuttering so poorly.
I think the record says that he was thanking him for assistance.
When you listen to the audio, he passes out twice as he's talking mid-word.
We did listen to the audio.
Uttering so badly, he's having trouble finishing words.
Okay, so but let's assume, all right, regardless of what happens there, the police officer is not asked to leave.
He's not asked to leave, but he removes Jacob's mother from the room, and there's reference through the record about removing his lawyer from the room as well. When we look at privacy interest, oftentimes the privacy interest is dependent upon the location, whether it's the phone booth, a hospital room, a dorm room, a hotel room. We look at the context of the privacy of what's occurring. And the United States Supreme Court made clear that we have expectations of heightened privacy in certain areas. I believe in a hospital room, that heightened expectation of privacy is paramount, no matter who you are, no matter what you go to the hospital for.
So let's say it is. Let's say if I agree with you and say that it is. Again, the officer comes in with the permission of the hospital, comes in the curtain area or the room, is not asked to leave. On the other hand, asks your client's mother to leave and lawyers to leave. So my surprise, the lawyer does leave. So they leave the officer and your client in a room by themselves. Is that correct?
That's correct. A 15-year-old boy who's highly intoxicated certainly doesn't know his rights and certainly isn't coherent enough to assert any rights.
Okay. And so then that's when, so would you agree then that the items are that he asked for collect are in plain view?
As to the plain view argument, the state never asserted that below, not at the trial court level, not at the court of appeals. The first time they raised that, it's here in this court, and I would argue plain view has been waived. They didn't file a brief in opposition to the motion to suppress. They didn't make arguments at the trial court when the suppression hearing occurred. They didn't file a post-hearing brief. So the first we're hearing plain view is in this court. And plain view doesn't apply if the officer, if the items that the officer is claiming plain view, he had no right to be there. In Athens versus Wolf, they have a search warrant for the one dorm room. They walk through the bathroom to the other dorm room and they start seizing items.
Well, counsel, if we believe or accept that only the hospital had the right to exclude the officer, where does that leave your argument there? In other words, it was their domain, not your client's.
Or to piggyback on that, or if we just say that nobody told him to leave, so he was there.
Well, that's true too.
What does that do to you?
The officer should have followed appropriate protocol in getting a warrant, securing the area and waiting for the warrant. And seeing as I'm down to below 2 minutes, I'd like to reserve.
All right, wait. Let's follow up on that. The question is that, or I guess the premise here is, it's the hospital's property. Your client is there voluntarily. The officer is there pursuant to his official capacity. No one asked him to leave. It is the hospital's property. What does that do to your argument of him having a privacy issue that was violated or the need for a warrant?
If the court finds there was a privacy interest that was violated, then the officer is not there lawfully.
Okay.
That privacy interest belongs to him that the hospital cannot waive.
All right, and what is the foundation for his privacy interest? Let's go back to that.
Even the cases cited by the state, People versus Yannick, State v. Jackson, all recognize a privacy interest when we go to the hospital. The Fifth Circuit found that when you go to a hospital for treatment, even if you're a victim or a suspect, you don't relinquish your privacy rights simply because you go for treatment. And the chilling effect, if we find otherwise, is that people won't go and their privacy won't be maintained.
Yet, counsel, the law allows for a blood sample to be taken from someone who is a suspect in a DUI against their will.
Not without warrant. The United States Supreme Court has made clear a warrant must be obtained for a blood draw. And in Ferguson versus Charleston, the United States Supreme Court, where they were surreptitiously doing blood tests on pregnant women who were showing up for prenatal care, the court said the government can't do that because they suspect drug use. They need to get a warrant.
Okay, but you're saying let's quickly go to the warrant that they did require, or they did acquire, and you're saying that the basis for the acquisition of that warrant is flawed.
Yes. Paragraph 7 of the affidavits for the search warrants reference what was observed and taken at the hospital earlier that evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Music?
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, fellow justices, Attorney Morrow. May it please the court. My name is Ashley Music. I'm a Trumbull County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney, and I represent the state of Ohio in this matter. The instant case arises from the March 31st, 2015 aggravated robbery, aggravated burglary, attempted rape, and brutal murder of 94-year-old Marie Belcastro, who was appellant's neighbor. And this was committed hours after he was released from the Juvenile Justice Center after serving time on a probation violation. There is no question of appellant's guilt in this case. From the overwhelming evidence, which consisted of stolen liquor bottles that were covered in the DNA of the victim and defendant.
Are you conceding? Are you saying so there were constitutional violations, but they're all harmless?
No, Your Honor. Well, that we are certainly not conceding error in any regards. But with that being said, the overwhelming evidence in this case, there's no doubt to appellant's guilt. And this court accepted just a single proposition of law, and that's in regards to the seizure of items taken from the hospital room.
Right, so why are you discussing his guilt?
Because there are three points I'm hoping to sort of make this morning to the court. First is that many of the claims that have been raised by opposing counsel were never raised in the court below. This was an issue that was not briefed extensively to the appellate court below, and these arguments were not lodged in the trial court. Secondly, there's no remedy discussed by appellant of what relief they're seeking here, other than the blanket statement that these items should have been suppressed. And notably, some of these items were not even part of the factual basis given by the assistant prosecutor during the plea hearing or as a basis for appellant's plea here. Well, and
Go ahead, say your last point.
Lastly, the seizure in this case was not done by the government. It was not done by government action. There is no Fourth Amendment implications. And even if this court were to find that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy, something the state does not concede here, it was reasonable that they seized these items in this instance. And then lastly, because the evidence was so overwhelming, we would ask this court, if they were to find error, that it is harmless beyond doubt.
Why wasn't it reasonable to secure a warrant for the seizure of the items that belong to Barossa?
Okay, so first off, this is there's a kind of a lot of things at play here. So first, we know that the officer does go to St. Joe's in order to secure a homicide suspect. He is there, he puts LaRosa into custody, he cuffs him. At that point, he's already been disrobed for treatment. He is not taking the clothing off LaRosa. He has not asked for it to be removed and given to him. This was property that was removed for treatment purposes. These are blood-covered boxers and blood-covered socks.
But nonetheless, his.
Yes, this was now in the custody, if you will, of the nurse. It is in plain view while the officer is legally there to secure a homicide suspect.
But nonetheless,
his. Yes. So he did. He did seize this evidence. And importantly, what happens in an emergency room or a trauma room such as this? We are taking clothing off to assess an individual for treatment. It is very likely such evidence, whether it be because the person's a victim of a crime or because they are a suspect in a crime, would be lost or destroyed. So here, yes, the officer took it. He is safeguarding this evidence, securing it so that it is not lost and destroyed.
How would it be lost and destroyed when the officer was there to secure LaRosa as a suspect in a crime?
Absolutely. He was there to secure LaRosa.
How would his clothing be lost or destroyed?
Just like anything else is thrown away or discarded by hospital personnel during the treatment facility, like during the treatment process. So our argument would be, this was clearly safeguarded by law enforcement. Yes, we did receive warrants in regards to other evidence.
So why wasn't a warrant obtained for those items?
These items were actually taken prior to warrants being executed as to that other property. So there are two warrants that were secured that evening, one being the swabs of his hands, buccal swabs, as well as swabs of his groin area. The second warrant was a warrant for his address on Lafayette, where bloody clothing, his jeans and his t-shirt and his tennis shoes were seized pursuant to that warrant.
So what authority do you have? Why is it that the officer was lawfully able to seize his clothing, and I'm not talking about anything that may have been on the sheets or the washcloth, but his items without a warrant?
Okay, so again, it was two parts here, and really the trial court relies on State v. Drain, and in Drain they found no reasonable expectation of privacy where an individual who purports to be a victim, and that's what Mr. LaRosa did in this case. Mm-hmm. He claimed he was beaten and he was transported to the hospital covered in blood via ambulance and taken to the emergency room.
I want to ask a couple questions on your facts.
Yes.
I'm very confused.
Okay.
My understanding, I've read the suppression hearing trial transcript. I've read the warrants and the entry of the trial court judge. You say all the clothes were bloody, but there is no testimony that I can find at the suppression hearing that there's any blood on his boxers or socks. So let's just start there. Where is that in the record that someone's testifying that there's actual, that patrol officer Biddlestone sees blood on the socks or boxers, and that is really why he asked the nurse to give them to him? I've read his testimony. I don't see that. So help me.
Okay. So in regards to the to that, I do believe that there is testimony. I do not have the exact pages. He was dispatched to the hospital for a homicide victim, and there was also testimony at the suppression hearing. He was covered in blood. He had no visible injuries.
Okay, so Officer Biddlestone, who's a patrol officer, gets a call from public service, not over the radio, that he is to go to the hospital. The individual mm-hmm. he's going to see has already been identified as a murder suspect. So he's already identified as a suspect. According to his own testimony, he goes in, he finds these long hairs, he takes that evidence out, he then gets his mic pack, puts his body camera on, and goes back into the hospital. At that time, the defendant is still clothed on a gurney. His clothes are removed, and what he says in cross-examination is he told the hospital to give them to him. Now he knows he's a suspect. There is no warrant. And if I can find the exact page, what he says is, that's when that was gathered by the nurse, and we had a brown hospital bag, and I assume they took them from a closet. And that's what we put the socks and underwear into. We bagged them separately. And when he was talking about this, he said that I was not going to let them out of my sight, things that I believed would be part of a warrant. So he knows he doesn't have a warrant for these items. He never testifies as to seeing blood on these items. So you never raise plain view until you get here to this court. So tell me how you get to plain view based on his own testimony and that he's not seizing them, going back to what Justice Stewart said.
Okay, so just so that I am following here, I do believe in the transcript at page 60 and 80, Biddlestone does testify that the appellant was disrobed when he arrived. Okay, so I do know that. In terms
Counsel,
of-
would you repeat, counsel, repeat what you just said. I couldn't hear you.
In terms of the transcript at page 60 and at page 80, that Biddlestone did testify that appellant was disrobed. He was no longer clothed in the boxers and have his socks on when he arrived. So I have that as page 60 and page 80 in the suppression.
So his actual answer is, so when I went back into the room, they were obviously disrobing him. So on his first admittance into that hospital room, the suspect was clothed. So when I went back into the room, they were obviously disrobing him and all he had was socks and boxers. They were going to put a gown on him for examination purposes. So that's when that was gathered by the nurse. And we had brown hospital bags, and I assume they took them from a closet or, you know, storage. And that's what we put the socks and underwear into. Separate bags, obviously.
Right. And at the trial court, while we certainly did not explicitly argue plain air was not discussed at the in the trial court entry. It is mentioned in some of the reasoning. I'm sorry, Justice Brunner.
Do you mean plain view or plain error?
Oh, plain view. I'm sorry. Thank you for that correction. So plain view is a reasoning that is discussed in Drain. But what the trial court found here was just that he has no reasonable expectation of privacy when he purports to be a victim. And that's what Drain holds. And that was what was argued at the trial court. Now, granted, none of these arguments regarding bailment in some of these cases were argued by appellant at the trial court. It was a simple general argument of reasonable expectation of privacy. And the trial court found no reasonable expectation of privacy based on Drain. That's exactly what the appellate court found when reviewing the record in this case. They noted that the seizure was not done by government action. That does not implicate the Fourth Amendment. It also discussed-
Let me ask you, isn't Drain distinguishable? Because in those facts, the police weren't going there to interview Drain as a suspect, correct? They actually thought he was an innocent victim, unlike the facts in this case.
So, Your Honor, you are correct that they were originally in Drain going to, because they were alerted there because someone was shot. It was like he was a gunshot victim. He was notified that someone was injured in the hospital. Police went to investigate that. However, when the police entered the area where they would lawfully be because they're investigating a crime, they noticed in plain view the clothing that matched the description that the robbery suspect was wearing at the time of the robbery and at the time of the crime. And it's very similar in this case. Well, yes, by the time Biddlestone was dispatched to St. Joe's, there was an indication he's a possible homicide suspect because he's covered in blood with no visible injuries. However, upon entering there to lawfully secure a suspect, based upon this evidence, these clothes were in plain view. Certainly that wasn't discussed by the trial court. The state is not going to suggest otherwise. But again,
That was the reasoning in Drain. The trial court didn't go that far. The trial court just left it as no reasonable expectation of privacy when you show up purporting to be a victim.
Well, follow-up on that, actually two follow-ups. There really is some ambiguity in the record about the underwear and the socks, and the trial court didn't really resolve it, and the Court of Appeals didn't really deal with it either. But you know, when you're talking about all this evidence and you're saying that as a fallback, there's harmless error, how can you do that with a no contest plea? This wasn't a trial.
Okay, so it's actually, I think, rather simple in regards to that question. So unlike where you have a jury trial, where you could possibly, or even a bench trial, where you could possibly make some claim that this evidence tainted the proceedings so badly that we need to overturn the conviction. That's not what we have here in the plea. And in fact, the one case that's been supplemented by appellant, that would be the Pearson case, there's a discussion about where this evidence that was taken, it should have been suppressed, and it was the only evidence of that crime. That's why a conviction or a plea would be overturned. And in fact here, appellant never argues that his plea is somehow invalid now because we had the evidence of the underwear. I think to suggest that plea wouldn't have gone forward would be quite disingenuous in light of the overwhelming evidence in this case. And that's why the error here is harmless. Certainly you can say, and this court could find, there was a reasonable expectation of privacy and the underwear should have been suppressed. I exclude the socks solely because the socks weren't even mentioned in the factual basis for the plea, wasn't even considered. As a basis during that plea. And in with that regards, we have the underwear, and the underwear being the only piece of evidence that would have been suppressed. It's disingenuous to think that there wouldn't have been a plea in this case.
Counsel, two questions here. One, did the officer who arrived at the hospital have noticed that there was a possible rape involved, or was it just the murder?
I believe at that time it was just that there was a possible homicide suspect.
Okay. Getting to the basis for the warrant to take the hand swabs, apparently that was based on the clothing, correct?
No, the warrant was not based upon the clothing. That's my understanding. So we have multiple testimony, or at least multiple pieces of evidence, that say this defendant had blood all over his body. That from the time that he was discovered by his mom, transported to the emergency room, every person who came in contact said he was covered in blood. And the seizure of the boxer shorts and the socks really had nothing to do with the basis of securing a warrant for his hands to test for blood or DNA material. And in fact, if you look at the warrant for the house as well, it doesn't, there's nothing to suggest that that seizure of the underwear and the socks had anything to do with the basis of wanting to seize the clothing that had been discarded prior to emergency personnel arriving at La Rosa's home. So again, the underwear and the socks that were sort of taken, again, the socks not even providing a factual basis for this case.
Okay, so then if you exclude the underwear and the socks, there was still basis and other contents of the affidavit for securing the warrant for the hand swabs, correct?
Overwhelming, Your Honor.
Okay, I may be confused, but I thought that your opposing counsel said that the clothing was the basis for the warrant, and therefore that the warrant and the contents were tainted.
No, so and at least that's not my impression. There was a lot of other evidence to secure the swabs of his hands. Now, the observation of the nurse when she wiped appellant and noticed that there was blood on the hospital wash rag, that information, when relayed to law enforcement officials, was used as a basis of securing the swabs of the genital area.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Morrow, would you address that? I thought you told me that, but for, this is my impression, I could be wrong, but for the bloody, or excuse me, the underwear and the socks, somehow the warrant for the hand swabs would not have been obtained. You'll have to unmute yourself.
I'm sorry. Paragraph 7 of the affidavits for the search warrants delineates what occurred at the hospital and the items that were taken. We don't know, because it wasn't litigated, but for those items, would there have been a sufficient basis? What we do know is that this is constitutional error if there is error, and the issue isn't overwhelming evidence of guilt. It's, is there a reasonable possibility evidence, the improperly seized evidence contributed to the conviction? We know there is, because the prosecutor listed the bloody socks and the blood from Jacob LaRosa taken. With regard to how he arrived at the hospital, the record is clear. His pants, shoes, and shirt were removed at the house, and they were taken at the house. He arrived at the hospital only in underwear and socks. So while Officer Biddleston may have thought they had already taken those off at the hospital, because when he arrived, all he had on was underwear and socks, in fact, those items were taken off at the house and obtained pursuant to search warrant from the house.
Ms. Morrow, this, he was taken to the hospital between 5 and 6 p.m. And as they were putting him in the ambulance, the people from across the street stopped one of the officers to say, oh, this has happened to my mother or to the victim. And the search warrant was obtained about 10:40 p.m. And actually, in between that time, he became a murder suspect. They sent actually a patrol officer to the hospital to secure him as a suspect in the murder. And that's when the officer found LaRosa in the private room of the emergency department and handcuffed him to the rails of the hospital bed. So I guess what I'm saying is there's probably a 4 to 5 hour period between when they got the warrant. So it doesn't look to me like the washcloth really was the sort of the motivator to get the warrant.
Paragraph 5, 7 of the affidavit lists everything that they seized clothes. There was blood on his penis. It doesn't just focus on the washcloth, Your Honor. Several other states, Illinois, New York, Virginia, Michigan, Florida, and the Fifth Circuit have all found a right to privacy when we're at the hospital. And at the hospital, those cases all say the hospital does not have a right to turn over clothes that have been taken in the emergency room. In Minnesota versus Olson, as to the privacy issue, even if you don't have control over who comes and goes, or legal interest in the location, you can still have a privacy interest. The United States Supreme Court has consistently made that clear in places of employment, where the employee doesn't have a right to control who comes and goes, or access or egress, but still maintains a privacy interest. Commercial areas where the public cannot just—
Excuse me, I just have to ask you, since we're dealing with a seizure, what does the privacy interest matter? When seizure law isn't about private expectations of privacy, it's about ownership, right?
Under Katz, there's a two-prong analysis.
What kind of case was Katz?
Katz was a phone booth, and right. They found he had an expectation of privacy in the phone booth.
But it was a search, right? It wasn't.
Yes.
The Fourth Amendment deals with two things, searches and seizures, and they have different standards.
Yes, and the two-prong analysis that is employed when we look at is there a violation of the Fourth Amendment is there government action, and is there a subjective and objective expectation of privacy?
Wait a second. That's not the test for a seizure, though. The government can't take my property whether I have an expectation of privacy in it or not. They can't illegally seize it.
That's correct. In Athens versus Wolf, the Ohio Supreme Court used the Katz test to say, was there government action here? And was there a subjective and objective expectation of privacy? Once those two foundations are met, you then look to see was there an exception to the Fourth Amendment? And in this case, there was not a valid exception to the Fourth Amendment.
But Ms. Morrow, the washcloth was not used at the officer's direction. Mr. LaRosa was laying there, accidentally urinated on himself, and the nurse, being a nurse, took the washcloth to wipe him off and clean him off. I don't think in any scenario, as much as hospitals will parse out the billing, I have never seen a bill for a washcloth that could actually be washed and used again. So I don't know that somehow, because he would be paying or responsible for the hospital bill, that washcloth would ever be assigned to him as property. I'm having difficulty.
The question becomes whether or not the hospital had authority to turn that cloth over. And it doesn't matter if it's a vial of blood, a syringe, or a catheter with urine in it. The hospital doesn't have lawful authority to breach Mr. LaRosa's privacy rights, his privileges under Ohio law and HIPAA, and start turning things over to the police. They simply don't have that possessory interest in things that contain his bodily fluids. And we know this washcloth contained his bodily fluids.
Understand, but we don't know when the hospital, and the trial court didn't parse it out, when the hospital actually tendered that washcloth to him, because by 10:40, he had a warrant.
Oh, we do know. Officer Biddleston says he put that in a bag and took it out to his trunk when he took the underwear and the socks.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Before the warrant, correct?
Correct. Before the warrant.
Thank you.
Counsel, once the suppression motion was denied and your client entered a no contest and the state laid out the factual basis for these charges, there was a lot more specificity about evidence not subject to this suppression, right?
Correct.
So how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that this is harmless error?
Under the Madrigal decision cited in Brown that the state cites, if it's a constitutional error, it's not is there enough evidence without this for the conviction? It's was there a reasonable possibility this evidence contributed to the conviction? We've got him within 2 weeks of this denial, entering the no contest plea, and we have the prosecutor on page 13 of the plea hearing listing these items. So we know there's a reasonable possibility this contributed because it was submitted to the court in order for the court to enter a finding of guilt on the no contest plea.
You think if these items were taken out and they were the suppression was granted, that based on all the other what your opposing counsel says is overwhelming evidence, it wouldn't have resulted in a conviction of murder here.
There certainly isn't anything in the record one way or the other, but when a trial attorney advises a client on a no contest plea, you're looking at everything that's facing you. And certainly things that are taken from a hospital, from the defendant's body, had to have some impact on defense counsel's thought process and reasoning. And one of the reasons it had an impact is they entered the no contest plea and negotiated for it to preserve this issue for appeal.
So Ms. Morrow, I just want to understand your discussion with Justice DeWine and the argument I think you're making. The issue of who has a possessory interest in the washcloth is not your argument. Your argument is that the hospital is without authority to turn over an item that contains a suspect's bodily fluid without a warrant.
Correct. And the cases cited in my brief under the bailment and lawful authority to consent all support that.
In this case, the bodily fluid was not extracted from the defendant, correct?
It was removed from his body.
It was not extracted from his body.
No, in Funk, it was extracted with the catheter and they found you couldn't take it.
Right, here, there's no catheter here.
There's no catheter, but it wasn't,
for all they knew, he was a victim. And he urinated on himself and they washed him with a cloth.
Well, they did know he was a suspect in a homicide, and this urine wasn't sitting on the floor in the hospital room. It was on his body.
So by the time, before the nurse does this action, he's already handcuffed to the bed, correct?
Correct. If there are no further questions, I am well over my time.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, ladies. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marsha, we call a 10-minute recess.
Thank you.
The court will now take a brief recess.